sure you've had it happen. Somebody walks into the room that you're in, and everything changes. That person walks in, and just because of who he is, or just because of what she stands for, chairs get rearranged, and the schedule for the evening gets altered. People jockey for position, and they try to get in line. And the more interested you are, the more connected you are, the more involved you are in what that person stands for, represents, what that person is involved in, the more that it matters to you, the more your life gets shaken by his or her presence. In fact, that's part of what's going on with the Liberia team right now. They had some travel problems. They had some connection problems. They had some delays that required additional visas. And then they were hoping to get out of Ghana and get into Liberia. Well, some guy from the States showed up in Ghana yesterday, Barack Obama, and everything ground to a halt. They couldn't even get from their hotel to the airport. I think the next flight goes out on Wednesday. So they're just not sure what they're doing. That's why we were praying this morning. But that person, he's pretty important. He shows up and life changes kind of in crises ways, good or bad crises. It was good for people to have him show up, but it was kind of difficult for our team. I remember one time in our own lives where we had that moment where someone important showed up and it really changed things. Both my kids over their growing years were involved in theater. They love it much. Kirsten's just a wonderful vocalist, loves the music. Chris is a performing arts major at Clemson. So they're both, their hearts are really in that direction. They just love what you can do in theater. And when a little longer than that, when the Phantom of the Opera came to Greenville, we had tickets to see the show. As we anticipated seeing the show, I actually just, in a really random moment, I got an email from a former professor of mine. I was a theater arts major at the University of Redlands back in California, back in not that long ago. And he saw an article I wrote online, and he contacted me, and we exchanged emails a little bit. And then he said, "You might be surprised to know that my son, Brad Little, is the lead, plays the Phantom in Phantom that's coming to Greenville. Are you interested in the tickets?" I said, "Well, we already have our tickets, but if my kids could meet Brad, that would be..." And so he emailed me back and said, "I think I can arrange that." And we didn't have anything, I didn't have anything in writing, but Brad's dad said, "Just go to the stage door. Brad says he'll see you after the show." So after the show, and it was just a phenomenal show, Brad Little does a great job with that part. We went back to the stage door, and there's all kinds of people waiting for autographs and everything else. And I made my way up through the crowd and knocked on the stage door. Stage manager opened the door. "Yes. We're here to see Brad Little." I felt kind of like that Wizard of Oz moment. "Nobody sees the wizard." No. She pulled the door open. Yes, we're here to see Brad Little. He told us to come back. "Who are you?" "We're the Onkins." Just a second, she closed the door and left. Came back a few minutes later, opened the door. "Very nice. Oh, please come in." And the people standing in line were like, "Who are they? Who are they?" And so we got ushered back into his green room, the dressing room. And he was in the inner sanctum of the dressing room, finishing taking off his makeup. And we were standing in the green room where all of his costumes were. And my kids were like, "Oh, wow." And then Brad Little walked out. All the competition stopped. Everyone just kind of... Well, he was just a very average joke, very nice, very friendly. Took us on a tour of backstage of Phantom of the Opera. I mean, if you've ever seen the show, it's an amazing stage production. And he told us, "Here's things you don't see from the audience." It was really... Sue took a couple of pictures, and then Brad went, "No, don't take it." But we were just getting that backstage tour, and it was that we met him just radically changed that moment, that experience. Because of what he stood for and what we've seen him do, in a sense, his stepping into the room changed everything. With that in mind, I think about that moment was in one sense a crisis. What am I going to do? Brad Little is here. That's what's going on in Ghana. The President of the United States showed up. What are we going to do? With that in mind, I actually think that Jesus is probably the most crisis-causing person that you'll ever meet. It's not because he's ornery. It's not because he likes to make life difficult. It is because Jesus is the person who lives for what matters most. He is the one that's got it entirely right. He really lives for what matters most. And if what matters most matters to you, then when Jesus shows up, chairs are going to get rearranged. And, you know, he is, in that sense, the most crisis-causing person because he always seems to be doing life right. And that's often not quite the way that I do life. So if living matters to you, if living well matters to you, if living for what matters to you, Jesus is going to be a crisis-causing person. Hanging around him is going to upset things. We've seen that played out in the Gospel of Mark repeatedly. It's not that people aren't impressed by Jesus or awed by Jesus. They are. But even in those moments when they're impressed by him or awed by him or touched by him, life changes. Breaking into their world changes their world. Just think about it. He touches someone and heals them. They no longer can beg. Life is going to change for them. The forgiven can no longer settle down and live in their sin. The delivered are now freed to live differently. And those who have heard him teach are challenged to think about life from a fresh perspective. Meeting Jesus changes life. It's got to. He's the most crisis-causing person. Meeting Jesus in the pages of Mark is what we're all about. Meeting Jesus in the pages of Mark and how that translates to meeting Jesus in your life is what's most important. We're not just here doing a historical study of an ancient dead guy. The Jesus that we meet in the pages of Mark is alive and present in our world and messing with lives today. It is knowing this Jesus that results in us experiencing life. So we're on a journey through the Gospel of Mark because this real Jesus is at the center of real life. So knowing him and relating to him is what life is really all about, but he does create crises and trouble for people. That's what we've seen over the past few weeks. He shows up at Jerusalem. Good thing, Messiah to come to Jerusalem. He said it'd be a good thing. Have a party when he shows up. There's a lot of cheering and shouting going on, but then it turns to angry cries and other things before too long. And he shows up in Jerusalem and on the way in, he sees a fig tree and he looks at the temple. And he curses the fig tree. And he judges the temple. And most of the people hanging around Jesus are now troubled by him. What are you doing? What is going on? And here he is, in a sense, causing crises. Not again because he's ornery, just because. And in the midst of that, we've been looking at this for the past couple of weeks. You need to get a sense of the rhythm. Jesus sees the fig tree, then he sees the temple, then he curses the fig tree and it withers, then he judges the temple and it's empty. And then the disciples raise the question, and then the religious leaders raise the question. That's the pattern here in Mark chapter 11. He enters, and he sees the fig tree, and he sees the temple, and then he speaks to the fig tree, and he cleanses the temple. And then the disciples have a question about the fig tree, and then the religious leaders have a question about the temple. And last week, Charlie helped us understand a little bit about what was going on with the fig tree, and Jesus' answer to the stirring in the disciples' heart. Let's just pick up from there in Mark chapter 11 when Jesus returns to Jerusalem. They passed the fig tree in the morning and saw it withered from its roots. And Peter remembered and said, Rabbi, look, teacher, look, the tree that you cursed has been withered. And Mark tells us Jesus answered them. There's an implied question in what Peter is saying. Peter makes the observation the tree is withered, kind of like, how did that happen? Well, look, the tree you spoke to yesterday, it's entirely destroyed. How did that happen? And Jesus answers that. Now, last week, Charlie unpacked for us what is really going on, the underlying message of the temple and the fig tree and how it has everything to do with how the Lord wants real worshipers and wants to, like Chris shared with us, wants to get past the show to what's real, and what's real is real worship. And so those last two messages helped us understand that. But part of what is going on here is Jesus replying to Peter's kind of amazement, how'd the fig tree wither? How did that happen? And Jesus offers the explanation that Charlie unpacked for us last week when he says, have faith in God. Truly I say to whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea and does not doubt in his heart, but believes what he says will come to pass. It will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also who is in heaven may forgive your trespasses. That's a challenging passage, and Charlie walked us through. Don't lose sight that part of what's going on here, though, is Jesus is responding to Peter. How'd that happen with the tree? Short answer, dependence. What Jesus is saying when he says have faith in God, depend on, rely on the Father. So he starts with have faith, he ends with forgive so that your Father may also forgive you. It's about this dependent relationship. How does this kind of thing happen? Jesus is saying more than this, but he's not saying less than this. He's answering Peter's question. How did that happen? Jesus says, well, it happened because I'm depending on the Father, and I'm doing what the Father wants, and he backs that up. And so it's the fig tree scene and the temple scene and the fig tree curse and the temple judged and the disciples' question and Jesus' answer. And then we get to the religious leaders' question. That's just the momentum through this passage. And they ask a question. The disciples' question was, how did it happen? Jesus says it comes, this happened through dependence. But the religious leaders have a different question altogether. Their question is seen in chapter 11, starting in verse 27. And Jesus and the disciples came again to Jerusalem. And as Jesus was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him, and they said to him, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do them? And Jesus said to them, I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from man? Answer me. And they discussed it with one another, saying, well, if we say from heaven, he'll say, why then did you not believe John? But if we say from man, well, Mark tells us they were afraid of the people, for the people held that John really was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. And so Jesus said to them, neither will I then tell you by what authority I do these things. What's going on here? Well, notice that Jesus doesn't bump and run. What I mean by that is he doesn't come in, disrupt the temple, and then on his way, he leaves. No, he actually comes back. He hangs out in the temple. After he has radically disrupted things, he hangs out there. He continues to teach. He continues to speak. And in fact, he apparently is so approachable that the religious leaders feel comfortable walking up to him and saying, what do you think you're doing? Jesus isn't just bumping and running. Jesus apparently is even okay with their inquiry. They ask a question. Now, some people look at Jesus' answer here and say, oh, he's just being slick. He's being sly. He didn't want to answer them. He's being conniving. That's not Jesus' style. If you go back and watch Jesus' interaction with the religious leaders, the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees, throughout Mark, he is constantly inviting their engagement, their participation. They have a question? He says, it's a good question. Let's talk about it. They raise an issue. He goes, that issue needs to be addressed. Let me help you understand how I'm addressing that. They don't understand something, and they start questioning his disciples. He doesn't stun them. He brings them in and goes, okay, you asked that question. Let's talk about that. That's Jesus' approach with them. He is involving them. And so when Jesus responds to the religious leaders this way, I don't think he's pushing them off. I don't think he's playing games. I don't think he's being slick and sly. I think he wants to engage them. So what is going on when he says, let me ask you a question, and then I'll answer yours? I think what he is doing is, when he says, tell me what you think about John, I think he really wanted them to say what they thought about John. Because what Jesus is looking for is, you give me your understanding of authority, then I'll answer where mine comes from. Give me the basis for how you're thinking about authority, and then I can tell you about my authority. You tell me how you think about John, and then I can tell you how I understand my authority in relationship to what's going on. But they go, we don't have a yardstick for measuring authority. Well, then how do I answer your question? If you tell me, from man, we'll talk starting there about how we understand authority. If you tell me from God, then we'll start from there and we'll talk about authority. But when they go, we don't have a yardstick for measuring authority, Jesus goes, then I can't answer your question. How can I tell you how I understand authority if you don't have a yardstick to measure it? I don't think he's playing games. I think he's trying to engage them. But they go, no, we don't want to answer that. But Jesus doesn't let it stay right there. He actually presses on and answers their question if they're listening. Read with me, Mark chapter 12. And so he began to speak to them, to these religious leaders, in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a pit for the wine press and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season came, he sent a servant to the tenants to get from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. And they took the servant and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent to them another servant, and they struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and him they killed. And so with many others. Some they beat, some they killed. Well, he still had one other, a beloved son, and finally he sent him to them, saying, "They'll respect my son." But those tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What will the owner of that vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. Have you not read this scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And they, the religious leaders, were seeking to arrest him, but feared the people, for they perceived, the people perceived that, and the religious leaders, had perceived that he had told the parable against them. So they left Jesus and went away. And this is a parable. You got to remember about parables. Parables are stories used to drive home a point. Think of a parable like an arrow. An arrow has a business end. That's the end that sticks in things, right? That's the business end of the arrow. It has a shaft that gives momentum to the business end to make sure that the point sticks where it's supposed to stick, and has feathers that keeps the arrow moving in the right direction. Sometimes people read parables and they spend a lot of time on the feathers. And they talk a lot about the shaft. What we have to do is make sure that we're clear on what the point of the parable is. Some people look at this parable and go, well, it's an allegorical prophecy. An allegory is a story where there's a one-to-one correspondence. And they try to find one-to-one correspondence in this parable about things that are going on in life in the world. Like the servants are the prophets and Jesus is the son and the destruction of the temple. The destruction of the tenants. That's the destruction of Jerusalem that comes in 70 AD. And so some see this passage as kind of a story form prophecy about the coming destruction of the temple. It is true that the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and so was all of Jerusalem. And so there is the idea of coming destruction. But you know what? I'm reluctant to think that that's the point of this parable. Why? Well, because what gets destroyed in the parable is not the vineyard. It's the tenants. So if this was a prophecy about the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem, well, it's not quite clear. It doesn't. There might be something there prophetic, but I don't know that's the point. Some people look at this and go, well, this is the way that Jesus is proving that he's the Son of God. This is really about Jesus' identity. The final one sent is the Son. And they see in that, well, maybe it's true that Jesus is the Son, and is it possible that as Jesus tells this parable, there is some of that that filters in? Perhaps. But you know what? I don't think the tenants in the parable correspond then well to the religious leaders, because they don't recognize that Jesus is the Son. They're not thinking, we kill him, we get what God has. I mean, it doesn't walk on all fours. Although there may be an allusion to Jesus as the Son there, I don't think that's the point of the parable. Notice what it says in 12:12. It says, they, the religious leaders, understood that he told this parable about them. Huh. That must mean at least they weren't thinking, oh, this is about prophecy. This is about things that are going to happen in the city of Jerusalem later. No, they knew it was about them. They didn't go, oh, you're the Son. We missed that. We're really sorry. No, they didn't understand it was about him. They understood that the parable was about them. It's not that there might not be other things there, but I don't want to miss the point. The point is what Jesus was driving at, and apparently they got it. The arrow went home. He's talking about us. So what did they get? What did they understand? Did they understand from the parable that Jesus is the Son of God? Doubtful. I don't think they saw that. Did they think that they were part of a prophetic scene that was about to be played out? I don't think that's what they understood. They knew it was about them. And if we listen to the parable simply, I think the point comes home very easily. If you were listening to this parable for the first time and not in this setting, and you listened to about what the tenants did to the servants and the everybody, and then when Jesus gets to the point where he says, well, what will the owner do? Well, he'll take the vineyard from those tenants. And you'd all go, yeah, well, of course. Duh, right. That's the point. The point is, listen, stewards are not owners. What's the point of the parable? Stewards aren't owners. Tenant farmers don't get to do whatever they want because they're just stewards. They're entrusted with somebody else's stuff. They don't get to do with what they have as if it were their own. The point of the parable is that stewards aren't owners and shouldn't act like owners. That's the answer to the question, by the way. They're asking the question, Jesus, why? Here's the heart. Their question is, Jesus, why do you have the right to upset what we're doing? Who gave you the authority to come in here and do that? What's behind their question? They're assuming they're the owners. They're acting like it's theirs. That's why they're upset. You come in, you're upsetting stuff. Why are they upset? Because they think it's theirs. So Jesus tells a parable to drive home this point. If you're not an owner, you don't get to do with it whatever you want. Tenants aren't owners. Stewards aren't owners. And Mark tells us they understood he was speaking that about them. But here's the problem. They couldn't let go of their own agenda. They were unwilling. They knew the parable was about them. But they weren't about to stop acting like owners. Wow. Jesus drives home this point with the quote he makes from Psalm 118. This is a passage in Old Testament prophecy. When he says, have you not read the scripture? He's not being rude, not being sarcastic. Have you never read? That's not how he said it. It's a polite way to say, you remember, right? You remember that passage from Psalm 118? It reads this way. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. How does that relate to what's being said? Builders aren't owners. You know that, right? Builders aren't owners. Builders work for the owner to build what the owner wants. The builders go, we don't want that stone. The owner goes, no, that's the chief cornerstone. That's the one I want. And what Psalm 118 says, it's the Lord's doing. That's what it's all about. It's the Lord's doing. When Jesus comes into the temple to cleanse it, to judge it, what does he say? You've made this a safe haven for sinners so that they can do their despicable stuff, but it's the Lord's house of prayer. It belongs to somebody else. You've just used it poorly. That's the point that Jesus is making with what he does in the temple when he comes in and explains to them what's going on and asks them about their sense of authority. And they don't answer, and then he tells this parable. He is trying to drive home the point. You're supposed to be stewards. You're acting like owners. And the whole question of authority revolves around that. So, as I begin to understand that, then I'm driven back to my own life and ask the question, so what do I do with all of this? My first response is, it doesn't apply to me. I'm off the hook. Because I'm not the boss of anything. I'm not in charge of God's business. I'm not in charge of God's temple. No big corporation answers to me. So, gosh, those guys are really wicked and bad. I'm glad Jesus gave them what they were due. But if you're reading it that way, then you miss what Jesus is saying. Because it's not about the magnitude of the stewardship. It's just about stewardship. It's not about how much you think you own. It's about that you think you do. So Jesus asked this question to you or me this morning. He says, so what's the source of your authority? What is the source of the authority in your life? What's the source? The truth is, no matter how you answer that, Jesus is willing to meet you there. He'll ask us the same question he asks the Pharisees and the religious leaders. What's the source of your authority? How do you understand authority? Unless you are at the point where you say, authority resides in me. I am the inherent determiner of my own fate and destiny. Unless you think the buck fully stops with you, then you're admitting that there is some authority outside of your life that has some say as to how you do life. The moment you say, there is some authority outside of my life, that is the moment that you have to admit I'm a steward then, not an owner. sometimes we don't readily admit that. I mean, I'll talk with a couple. They come in for marriage counseling. They're wrestling with some issue in their lives. They're in conflict. And I will ask them questions like, so what do you think marriage is all about? How do you understand marriage? Where did you get your idea of marriage? And you know, sometimes they'll go, well, it's just what I've always thought. This is what I think marriage is all about. Huh.
So you're the final determiner, right? You're the final authority? You're the owner of that? That's pretty whack. I don't say that in a counseling session. That just goes to my...
But the fact is, we tend to live there, right? We tend to live there. In the moments of crisis, we tend to back up and say, well, this is the way I... Of course, this is the way I should be, because this is how I... We do just what the religious leaders do. And I don't want to answer the authority question, because if I answer the authority question, then no longer am I in charge. If there's some authority out there, no longer am I the one in charge. So Jesus asked me that question, and then he follows it up by asking me. And asking you this morning, unless you are inherently seeing yourself as the authority in your own life, then you have to admit that there is authority outside of you. And if that's the case, then Jesus asks you this question this morning. Are you then living as a steward or as an owner? Do you carry out your daily life as if it is yours to spend as you see fit, however you want? As if your hours are your own? Do you live your life as if your days are yours to dispose of as you will? Do you carry on life in relationship with others as if your interaction with them is merely a matter of your choice and your desires? Do you labor at work thinking that the job you do is merely about you getting ahead or you making more? Do you study? Do you play? Do you care for your children? Do you mow your yard? As if what you do with your life is simply a matter of your own whim? If so, then you're living as an owner rather than a steward. And Jesus tells the parable then about us. We resist like religious leaders. Who gave you, Jesus, the right to speak into my life? Who told you could direct me in the ways that I should go? Who told you could shape my business, my relationship, my days? Where do you get off, Jesus? Where do you get that authority? Jesus' response is, wait. The real question is, are you the owner or a steward? If you resolve that, then now you know why I have the right and the authority to speak into your life. Jesus, it's interesting, Jesus leaves it very open-ended for these guys. He doesn't tell them. So that means, guys, you should be doing this. No, he just raises the question. Do you see yourself as a steward or an owner? As I was thinking about this, I remembered a passage from this marvelous novel, Les Miserables, by Victor Hugo, made into a musical. You might be familiar with it either from the musical or from the book. It's the story of a very hard life lived by a man named Jean Valjean and the transformation that takes place in his life. Jean Valjean is initially thrown into prison because he was trying to meet a need. He was accused of being a thief. He resisted and pushed against it. Ultimately, in prison for many years, grew very bitter about how he had been treated. And when he's released. It's in the 1800s. He's released in France, but he still has a convict's record. So he can't get a job, and things are tight and hard for him. And he's going from place to place and is growing more and more bitter and more angry and in a sense, more and more wicked. He's just giving into that. And ultimately, someone points in the direction of this priest who lives on the outskirts of the city, and he shows up at the priest's door on a stormy night, and the priest welcomes him in. I'll be glad to give you food. And he says to Jean Valjean, anything I have is yours. You're welcome to any of it. Consider this your home. Well, partway through the night, Jean Valjean wakes while everyone in the house is sleeping, and he steals some silver, spoons and forks, and is going to sell them to try to make some money. And as he flees, he is caught by the police running through town. He looks suspicious.
Wrong time of night to be running. The clanking when he ran, that gave him away. But anyways, the police take him back to the priest's house. And this is the encounter that ensues. There's a knock at the door. "Come in," says the bishop. And the door opens. A strange, fierce group appeared on the threshold. Three men were holding a fourth by the collar. The three men were gendarmes, policemen. The fourth was Jean Valjean, a brigadier of gendarmes, the chief of police, who appeared to head the group, was near the door. He advanced toward the bishop and gave a military salute. And as he begins to speak, the priest interrupts. "Ah," turning to Jean Valjean, "there you are. I'm glad to see you. But I gave you the candlesticks also, which are silver like the rest, and they would bring you 200 francs. Why did you not take them along with the silverware?" Jean Valjean stood there with eyes open, looking at the bishop with an expression which no human tongue could describe. "Monseigneur," said the brigadier, "then what this man said was true? We met him. He was going like a man who was running away, and we arrested him in order to see, and he had this silver..." And the bishop interrupted again. "And he told you that it was given to him by a good old priest with whom he had passed the night. I see it all. And you brought him back here. It's all a mistake." "A mistake? If that's so, then we can let him go?" "Certainly," said the bishop. So the gendarmes released Jean Valjean, who shrank back and said, "Is it true they let me go?" He said in a voice almost inarticulate, as if he were speaking in his sleep. Yes, you can go. "Don't you understand?" said the policeman. And then the bishop spoke again. To Jean, he said, "My friend, before you go away, here are your candlesticks. Take them." And he went to the mantelpiece and took the two candlesticks and brought them to Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean was trembling in every limb. He took the two candlesticks mechanically and with a wild appearance. "Now," said the bishop, go in peace. By the way, my friend, when you come again, you don't need to come through the garden. You can always come in and out through the front door. It's closed only with the latch, day or night." And then turning to the police officers, he said, "Monsieur, you can retire." And the police left. And Jean Valjean stood there, feeling like a man who is about to faint. And the bishop approached him and said, in a low voice, "Never forget. Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I am buying. I withdraw it from dark thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I give your soul to God." The rest of the story is about the amazing transformation that goes on in Jean Valjean when he realizes he's a bought man. "I used to be my own man. I was wicked and given to wickedness. And this priest, because of mercy and two candlesticks, bought me out of that." He lived like his life belongs to another, and it does now. The priest could have sent him to prison, could have left him there to rot. This would have been his second offense. He would have been life in prison in France at the time. But because of mercy and two candlesticks, his life is given to him freely. But it's not any longer his own. The priest makes it clear, "I bought your life and I gave it to God." And so much more than that has happened to you. If you've come to know Jesus, then the truth is that you have been bought by the mercy of God and not for two candlesticks. But your very soul has been purchased by the mercy of God, by the blood of the Son himself. Earlier on in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus said, "For the Son has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom." Do you know what a ransom is? It's the payment that you make to get something for yourself. Jesus died to buy you. To buy you out of death. To buy you out of slavery to sin. To buy you out of selfishness. To buy you out of the domain of darkness. And to give you life
yes, give your life freely, but now you belong to another. You are not your own. Paul can say it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. He says, don't you understand that you are not your own? You have been bought with the price. You belong to God. He does not redeem you and give you life so that you can now have life on your terms. That's what he bought you out of. You were living as if you were the owner of your life. You were not. You were ensnared by sin and death. He bought you out of that so that you could have life. But now you have life as a steward. You've been redeemed and purchased and rescued and made his so that you could have life with him as a steward, not as an owner. What does this mean? Does this mean,
well, we'll all go off and be missionaries?
No, no. Maybe. Maybe some of you. But it does mean how you live your daily life. Do you live it as an owner of your days or a steward? Are you living as if it is yours to spend as you see fit, however you want? Are you living as if your days are yours to dispense with and dispose of at your will? Do you carry on life in relationship with others as if your interaction with them is merely a matter of your preference? Do you study? Do you play? Do you care for your kids? Do you mow your lawn? As if what you do with your life is simply a matter of your own whim. Or do you realize you're a steward, not an owner? This, in fact, is what we want to celebrate and make much of today. In just a minute, we're going to take communion together. If you know Jesus, if, in fact, you have gotten to this place in your life where this transaction is made, his life for your life, if you've embraced that, welcome to his sacrifice for your sins, then you're welcome to this table. But what do we do when we partake of this bread and this cup? In 1 Corinthians, Paul writes and says that what we do in the table is proclaim his death. What does it mean to proclaim his death? What will it mean for you this morning to proclaim his death? Does it mean your sins are forgiven? Yes. Does it mean because of his grace and his gift and you get to go to heaven? Yes, that's what it means. But what else does it mean? It means ransom. He gave his life a ransom to buy you to... A transaction was made in the heavens between the Father and the Son. They saw us sold into slavery of sin, and Jesus said, I'll buy them out. And Father, I'll make them a gift to you. You are not your own. You have been bought with a price. You belong to another. And your days now get to be lived not as owner, but as steward. What will that look like for you? I don't know. But that's the question that needs to be answered. Are you living as an owner? Or are you living as a steward? And this morning when you take the bread and when you take the cup, that's what you are proclaiming. We proclaim his death until he comes. You bought me. Let's celebrate that together.